Hey, I'm Ramesh from Cleveland, Ohio.
I'm Jeff from New York.
Howdy, I'm Sarah Slaman from Houston, Texas.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. When Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham set out to make the TV show Playing House, they knew that other shows about female friendships missed something.
I think we just wanted to show, that women just don't really have it together. We watched Sex and the City, and we definitely connected to the emotional stuff and the friendship part. But the part where you're
wearing a tutu and that
fantasy.
The Manolas all over town.
Yeah, you're not going to find that in Playing House.
No.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham about how Playing House came together from training with the improv comedy veteran Ian Roberts, and about the emotional center of the show, their real-life friendship.
You know, you're always, just one step away from, having a raisin stuck to your ass all day.
Right. And you're and thank God you have a best friend because no one else would tell you.
Hey, guess what? You have a raisin.
Then later, I'll talk to Hari Kondabolu. Usually when comedians are starting out, they have to deal with a lot of hecklers. Hari was doing progressive political jokes in Seattle, so he didn't have to worry too much about that. Mostly his problem was that sometimes progressive activists kind of don't get laughing.
I hear a lot of people say, I don't really like comedy, but I like you. Or I've never been to a comedy club before, but I really want to see you. And you also deal with folks who don't know how comedy clubs work.
We'll talk about Hari's stand-up and about what happened when he called out the racism of the Simpsons character Apu on national television. Then the voice of Apu, Hank Azaria, saw it. Then, in 1969, the band King Crimson released its debut album. It was called In the Court of the Crimson King. The music was as ambitious as the title. And I'll tell you about the special gift of Harvey Pekar. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Male friendship is well represented in comedy. Really, really well represented. But female friendship, less so. When we do see female friendships, the characters tend to be archetypal. Think of Friends or Sex and the City. Lennon Parham and Jessica St. Clair have a different way of framing things. They've been working together for years as improvisers at the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York and Los Angeles, and now they're working together on a USA show, Playing House. Their characters are less Carrie and Miranda and more Laverne and Shirley. You can actually imagine them being friends. In Playing House, St. Clair's character Emma left her hometown to work in Shanghai. She comes home to her best friend Maggie's baby shower, that's Parham. They accidentally discover that Maggie's husband has been cheating on her online. It's all kind of silly, but it's not afraid of genuine feeling. In this scene, Emma crams into a tiny backyard shed with Maggie. Maggie's been crying over the end of her marriage.
Really bad for a while.
Max, why didn't you tell me?
Come on, it's embarrassing. I mean, you're over there in Shanghai, hobnobbing with Asian high rollers, trading, I don't know, diamonds for briefcases of money.
What are you talking about?
I don't know, that's what happened in Skyfall.
Okay, my life is nothing like Skyfall. Okay? Daniel Craig is not my boyfriend. I don't even have a boyfriend. I don't have any friends. It's pretty depressing.
Okay. I just wanted to make a right choice.
I know, but listen, you did. You made the right choice for then. All right, you were what, 25?
Yeah.
You know, you lost both of your parents. You wanted someone safe.
What am I gonna do now?
You know what? We're gonna figure it out. But we don't have to figure it all out tonight.
I spoke to Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham last year. Jessica, Lennon, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. We're very excited because
it's very formal. It feels
in this
very
room,
fancy.
Our voice sounds like an NPR voice, and it's very exciting. It's not the normal screech owl voice that comes out of my mouth in normal life.
That's exciting.
I read somewhere that on your last show, which was a network sitcom for NBC, what you did when you were writing it was – break it down in terms of story beats, which is a normal thing that sitcom writers do.
Yeah. Sure.
And then basically go in a room with a tape recorder and improvise the scenes over and over and just write down the jokes that you like the most.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, you would have thought perhaps that process would have killed us in BFF. And it almost did, that we would change that. But we didn't. We did that again, but we perfected it, which is now what we do is we have a writer's room and they actually come into that room that we're
improvising in.
So we break it with a writer's room and then maybe the two writers or three writers that are sort of focused on that episode will come in and they'll watch us play all the parts. So it looks like two crazy people. Lennon plays all the men because she can really get into a man's POV.
Okay. That's inappropriate.
But like if you can imagine like during the romantic scenes, Lennon's playing the man with me and then we have three guys in the writer's room that are just like, do we leave? Do we stay?
No, you stay there and you watch it.
You watch it.
But it was the only way we could really capture the way that Jess and I finished each other's sentences and overlap each other, or just like the way people really talk in life and
the weird things they say. We're really
obsessed with. Yeah, when you're in a fight, when you're like in a crazy fight with someone, there are funny moments, there are heartfelt moments, but mostly you're saying insane things like, well, why don't you be a robot? You know, like that kind of thing.
Ian Roberts, who's one of the founders of the UCB, he always taught us in our classes that your subconscious mind is where the actual funny lives. Your conscious mind is filled of all the things like
the tropes.
The Chevy Chase, like, Fletch jokes that have been like lodged in there since seventh grade.
Yeah, the things you thought were funny when you were like 11.
Yeah, and so in order to get into that subconscious mind, the only way Lennon and I can do it is to improvise.
Do you remember meeting each other?
Oh, yes. Well, we saw each other across a crowded room a couple times.
Taking each other in. There were two things. I saw Jess perform, and she was screaming at someone on the ground. I remember that. And then
was I on the ground?
No, there was another woman on the ground. Who would that have been?
Tara Copeland, probably.
Okay. And then the second time I saw her, so then I knew about her because everybody was like, Jessica St. Clair, Jessica.
Oh, come on,
man. Oh, Jessica St. Clair, she's so funny. And then she was like booking Wendy's commercials, which was like at the time, like,
listen,
as high as you could soar.
You could sell a Wendy's salad on TV. Yeah. I mean, you had it made. You were the queen.
It's true.
You could take a bite of that chili and then smile.
It's true.
You know what was amazing during the shooting of that commercial? I kept taking a bite and then doing what I thought was a mm-mm face, but it was really me shaking my head no. And they were like, you have to stop doing that. Also, it's very racist because I karate chopped a Chinese chicken salad in one of the spots, which I just thought was really pushing the limits of what was acceptable.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Lennon Parham and Jessica St. Clair. They are the stars and creators of USA Network's Playing House, which just returned for its second season. I spoke to St. Clair and Parham last year. Getting back to your romance of Lennon here.
Yes.
Part of what you wanted was specifically to work with a woman?
Well, I was desperate to write a story about female friendship and that kind of close best friendship that's almost, it is a romance, you know, it's like almost a romantic comedy, but starring two women. And because my personal best friendships in life have been so important to me with women. And I really felt like it wasn't being told on TV or in movies. And it wasn't until like Bridesmaids, honestly, that I felt like, oh, okay, it's happening again. You know, the golden days of like Lucy and Ethel and Kate and Allie and the Golden Girls, these were all shows that I was obsessed with and I felt like it hadn't happened in a while. At any rate, I thought it would never happen. And then I saw Lennon and she was wearing a sweater set and so was I. And I thought, I honestly was like, there must be something wrong with her because why is she spending all of her time underground? In this theater below a Gristiti supermarket.
A drippy supermarket.
Listen, yeah. I don't know if you were there when the power went out, but I'll tell you what, blood dripped on my head from the butchers above, and I had to excuse myself.
They were talking about like the money that they had gotten after an ASCAP performance was going to go to buying new bins to catch the drippings from the meat juice.
And I didn't understand why my mother hated coming there. I was like, get with it and get hip. And she was like, there's a smell here that I can't get out of my clothes. But at any rate, I knew that Lennon was a similar girl and that she was a nice girl that found her way into this weird labyrinth. And I thought maybe she'll have the same, you know, desire. And it turned turned out she didn't know she did, but she did.
I think one of the interesting things about the tone of your show, Playing House, is that it is set in a sort of small town, Anytown, USA. It is very what USA once called blue sky-y.
Oh, right.
You know, it's very vibrant and happy in its context.
Mm-hmm.
And both of your characters are, they're not necessarily like super aspirational the way that the Sex and the City women were.
Right.
Or super blue collary. They're sort of like nice, regular ladies.
Yeah. Ladies in sweater sets.
Yeah. But also there is an element of like, but we are going to go weird sometimes. Just
oh, yeah.
So you know.
I mean, there's an episode where Lennon dresses as a man for half of it. And I don't – USA hasn't seen the cut yet.
Yes, they saw it on Friday. We're getting notes today.
When America sees it, I mean, it's outrageous. But basically what we wanted to do is create this kind of what we call, for lack of a better word, and we really need to come up with a better word for it.
We call it
girl porn.
Oh.
Because
yeah,
girl porn is these beautiful houses with a wrapping station and and the makings for a chocolate chip cookie and, you know, out. And, you know, the perfect throw and this gorgeous little town. And that to me was like Gilmore Girls had that charm. And I used to, you know, escape into that. And so we always wanted to do something that had that kind of.
It's almost like a Nancy Meyers like layered look. But within that, the secret weirdos that we are kind of populating it. Because
right.
Jess and I don't think that we're alone in knowing that most women, although they appear and they are wearing a sweater set and they have a face full of makeup, underneath they're like falling apart
at the seams.
And you know, you're always like just one step away from like having a raisin stuck to your ass all day. You know, like
right. And you're like, and thank God you have a best friend
because no one else would tell you. Guess what? You have a raisin. So, I mean. We're just kind of like showing that, like pulling the veneer back. And so we always look great, but we're always saying crazy things.
Right. And we filled that town full of all of our best friends from the UCB. So it's like it's kind of like the Gilmore Girls Stars Hollow, but filled with all these UCB weirdos.
Yeah.
So it's got a little something for everybody.
So I want to play one more clip from Playing House. And my guests are the stars and creators of the show, Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham. And in this scene, their characters, Maggie and Emma, are in a hardware store. And there's just sort of browsing in the aisles, complaining about how they don't know anything about hardware. And they spot in an adjacent aisle Emma's ex-boyfriend, Mark, who's played by Keegan-Michael Key, and his now wife.
Hi, Maggie.
Hey.
Hi, Emma. It's nice to see you. Mark said that you're back in town.
Yep, back home. You know, just helping Fatty here plop out a baby.
That's me.
But good, look at you. You look like you just walked out of a Hollywood salon.
Oh, that's
just gorgeous. Not the two of us. You look like a couple of sister wives. Just, you know, is it his turn or my turn? Or okay. We're all taking a turn. So, anywho's.
Maybe we should go.
Yeah, but you know what? We should all hang out sometime.
Oh, I don't think we necessarily have to do that.
No, we definitely should. In fact, I am not leaving until we make firm plans.
Well, how about tomorrow?
Tomorrow? Wow, Maggie. What do you have on the docket?
You know what? That is a nice invitation.
Yeah.
Oh, then we can do brunch.
You know what? As much as I would love to have you in my home where I live, I have to work tomorrow.
Oh.
So it's
well, great.
Not good
then
for
it's
me.
Just us girls.
Are there things about lady friendship that as a dude I wouldn't know that you feel like you wanted to represent on TV that you think are funny?
I don't think we think that from that angle, like what do guys need to know about us girls? We just are trying to authentically represent what real girls are like in friendships
I meant only to speak humbly that it might be something that I don't know about. Not to say that it's your job to teach
no,
me.
No. But when we did a table read that was filled with our like closest guy friends, all comedians. And Nick Kroll said, what did he say, Jay?
He said, is this what, after we finished the reading, he goes, is this really what girls are like when we're not around? And I said, yeah. And he goes, God, I feel like Jane Goodall, you know, watching the gorillas. Like, because it does change. We do change. Again, we act a lot more normal around you guys. We keep a lot of that crazy locked inside. But then when we're alone, I mean, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
I think we just wanted to show, like, that women just don't really have it together. We watch Sex and the City, and we definitely connected to the emotional stuff and the friendship part. But the part where you're wearing a tutu and, like, you know, that fantasy.
The Manolas all over town.
Yeah, you're not going to find that in Playing House.
No, no.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Lennon Parham and Jessica St. Clair. Their TV show, Playing House, just returned for its second season. So you go to Tina's house, and it is an exceptionally, you know, it sort of looks like gorgeous. A design magazine house.
Yes, yes.
And it is kind of lifestyle porn.
Yes.
But what you learn is that she has the secret closet.
The hoarder closet.
Filled with all the things she's gotten from QVC from like 1996 to the present day.
21 microwave omelet makers and panini presses and loofahs, et cetera.
And somebody like Bird Bones, she is the perfect woman. She looks perfect. You know, she has this beautiful house. When we go to the brunch, there's like a million, you know, like croissants and
fruit
pastries. And we feel like these maniacs. And at one point we say to her, like, where do you keep all your junk? Like, where's your junk drawer? And she opens it up and it's got one of these, it's like this container store.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we find her hoarder's closet, she's so embarrassed.
But we are relieved.
We say this.
Because
hoarder,
we are like, oh, okay, so you are a real person with a hoarder's closet. You just keep it all in one insane place. Whereas it's coming out of, you know, it's
all
coming
of our pores.
Out. Yeah.
I think the main thing about female friendship is you cannot be truly close unless you confess your weirdness to each other. And there are certain girls who don't have girlfriends, and we're afraid of those women usually because they don't feel the need to say, like, oh my God, I just found a random thong in my purse and I don't know if it's mine. You know what I mean? And like, but that's what bonds us. Women like to say, I'm a mess, so am I.
There's an Amy Schumer sketch that perfectly articulates this, although to an extreme. But it made me laugh so hard. It's a group of women who come up and compliment each other on what they're wearing. And then the other woman has to say, no, I look like a piece of crap.
Yeah.
And that heightens. And then the very last woman comes up and says, they are like, oh, we love your red trench. And she's like, thanks. And then they all start killing themselves.
Yes.
Because it's like an unspoken thing in the female world. Like, I'm falling apart. This is how I'm falling apart. And you say, yes, me too, me too. Because you always, you want to be in the same place with your girlfriends and you want to be sharing the same, like, fears.
Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parham, their show Playing House is now in its second season on USA. After a break, we'll talk about the album that serves as the blueprint for prog rock. And comedian Hari Kondabolu will talk about the character Apu on The Simpsons and what it feels like to be offended by one of your favorite TV shows of all time. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Bullseye is brought to you in part by Simple, banking for people who like to be treated like people. You'll never get hit with overdraft or monthly fees, and you can create goals and start saving automatically a little each day. You can visit simple.com/bullseye to see the way banking should be.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you recite Taylor Swift lyrics better than Sir Patrick Stewart? Care to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts. That's npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It's time for Cannonball. Yahoo! We talk to experts about classic albums or albums that should be considered classics, and we find out what makes them great. And listen, some kinds of music everybody agrees on. Nobody says that the Rolling Stones don't belong in the canon. But what about Genesis, or Yes, or Emerson, Lake, and Palmer? Who will speak for the prog rockers? Prog rock had and has all the wrong markers for rock and roll authenticity. The music wasn't down and dirty. The songs weren't pop radio short. Sometimes they were downright long.
Classically trained musicians, a lot of them came out of conservatory in England.
And they used weird instruments for rock music. Synthesizers, flutes, horns.
A lot of them loved jazz. They worshipped Charlie Parker and Bill Evans. But they also loved rock and roll.
Rock and roll purists hated progressive rock. The prog rockers threw the blues out the window. They traded raw sexuality for instrumental virtuosity.
Tricky time signatures, noodly solos.
But prog has always had its loyalists. Mark Weingarten and Tyson Cornell are two of them. They're the editors of Yes is the Answer. It's a literary anthology devoted to the best of prog. They say that one landmark album was a blueprint for the entire genre, In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson. The album came out in the fall of 1969, but about 500,000 Londoners got their first taste of it that summer in Hyde Park when King Crimson landed a gig opening for the Rolling Stones. It's safe to say the audience will never forget them.
Blowing everybody away with Schizoid Man.
You come out with Schizoid Man as your opening number, you're going to make an impression on people.
It was the first face-melting track on In the Court of the Crimson King.
Just an onslaught. As a kicker to a record, it doesn't get much better than this.
I mean, it's just remarkably heavy for that time.
Exactly. I never understood what the hell he was talking about lyrically, but I didn't care. Blood rack, barbed wire, politician's funeral pyre. This ain't Stairway to Heaven, bro. This is something else entirely. This is when it gets really nuts. This is the very first time that prog fans just geeked out on an incredibly complicated interlude. It was the template for all prog music. Yes didn't even do this in the first two records, where you just had this kind of like upshift suddenly on a dime. Love it. Can't imagine what it was like for the Stones fans to be sitting there listening to this as the opener for the Stones, you know? I mean, as a 15-year-old listening to this with your Sennheisers on in your bedroom, you're just freaking out.
I just remember trying to figure out this Robert Fripp guitar part.
This guitar part is complicated. He's like bending notes with a wrench or something. Great drumming. God, listen to Giles drumming on this. I mean, this has zero basis in blues-based music whatsoever. This is completely untethered from all of that tradition. That's why I do think of it as the real first prog rock record. It contains all the touchstones of that genre. Multiple parts within a single song.
Movements.
That kind of virtuosity. The dynamics. The soft into the loud. With Fripp being the X factor, because it's like from another planet.
People look at, you know, Jimi Hendrix and
Page.
And Page, Clapton. I mean, people really pushing the limits.
Those guys were all blues-based guys playing blues scales.
Yeah.
Fripp is playing his, I don't know what, you know, his own scales. I don't know what he's playing.
Robert Fripp, I mean, he's a guy that really
took the advancements of musical technology, the early synthesizers, the sound techniques. Robert Fripp was the person that was paving that road. He was experimenting with those things. He was also known for not caring what people thought about his art.
He's a control freak, basically. But you're right, he is a singular musician. This song's called Moonchild, and it kicks off side two of the record. Now, this is a track that a lot of people tend to skip when they listen to the record. They have the remotes at the ready because this is a challenging track. It starts out beautifully like this, the way you're hearing right now, this lovely melody, this kind of like gliding melody, almost like a folk rock tune. And then it kind of devolves into this super abstract, freeform improv for about 12 minutes.
You also hear the influence of movies.
Yeah, that's the other thing about Prague. It feels like you're entering a spatial world that has real dimension to it.
It's a little challenging at times. Prague musicians ran into problems after this record. They wanted to do 20-minute versions of tunes, and they were getting difficult reactions from record companies with their royalty structures. If they only had 5 songs on a record, they were only getting paid for those 5 songs. So they devised a wonderful technique of breaking each song into movements, which allowed them to expand their royalty structure. This record, now when you go look at it, they do kind of break things down into movements, but when it came out, it was really just a bunch of long songs. And I think the world of Prague learned their lesson.
Fripp would have gotten paid a lot more. Had they used Roman numerals. The full title of this song is The Court of the Crimson King, including The Return of the Fire Witch and The Dance of the Puppets. A little Spinal Tapian, I'm going to say.
But it's that Mellotron.
Love that Mellotron. This is my favorite track of the record.
Rusted chains of prison moons are shattered by the sun. I walk a road, horizons change, the tournament's begun.
And then you have Pete Sinfield, of course, the lyricist, who is writing these, the king, queens, and knaves.
Yeah, and Sinfield is the component here that a lot of people don't realize as being very, very powerful because he wasn't on stage with the band.
The cracked brass bells will ring to summon back the Fire Witch to the court of the Crimson King. I think these lyrics are the instructions to Dungeons and Dragons. I believe that's what this is. That being said, I still love it. It's almost heavy metal in a way. Those big Mellotron block chords. No one had ever done that. It's powerful. It was just a totally fresh approach to rock and roll.
The keeper of the city keys put shutters on the dreams. I wait outside the pilgrim's door with insufficient schemes.
It just conjures up images in your mind's eye all the time, this music.
You get what you want out of it. Everybody gets something different out of it. This is the gravity's rainbow of music.
The reason why Court of the Crimson King is such an important record is that it was picked up by FM, Freeform Radio, in the States. It was really the first prog record that a lot of people heard. It's a legacy of exploration, of experimentation, of trying new things in rock and roll, expanding the palette of rock. And that's important for a lot of bands, even bands that aren't prog rock.
The metal crowd always looks back to King Crimson as being great. All of the Doom, Black Sabbath, I mean, that all pays a lot of homage to this record.
General rock audiences caught into this record. It opened the floodgates. Genesis, Yes broke through, Gentle Giant. That's why it's an important prog record, because it became that kind of entry point for a lot of mainstream rock fans. It just said, this is a new approach. This is something else we can do. It doesn't have to be AABA. You know, it doesn't have to be 12 Bar Blues. It doesn't even have to be the Moody Blues. You know, it could be something else. I love this ending.
Mark Weingarten and Tyson Cornell on what they consider to be the founding document of progressive rock, King Crimson's In the Court of the Crimson King. They're the editors of Yes is the Answer and other prog rock tales. It's now available in paperback. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Hari Kondabolu thought that he was going to law school. Then, somewhere between taking an AmeriCorps job organizing immigrants in Seattle and taking the LSAT, things changed direction. He started spending his nights on stage at comedy clubs. By the time he was done with his AmeriCorps commitment, he decided to bail on law school. He was going to be a stand-up. His comedy is deeply informed by his own experience as the child of immigrants and by his work as an organizer and his education in comparative politics. On the cover of his debut stand-up album is Hari standing like George Washington astride a rickshaw, a bicycle rickshaw, that is being pedaled by a white dude in a suit. The record is called Waiting for 2042. Here's Hari explaining the significance of that year.
I'm not the one that's obsessed with talking about race in this country. I'm not the one, right? I'm not the one who keeps bringing up 2042. How come I keep hearing about the year 2042 on the news? 2042, for those of you who don't know, is the year where, according to census figures, white people will be the minority in this country, right? They'll be 49%. No, who gives a Honestly, who gives a Why do I have to keep hearing about this? This number is not important to me. Are there white people in this country? That's who it's for, by the way. White people are freaked out. Are there white people in this country who are actually freaked out about this? Don't worry, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. Things seem to have worked out for you, all right? But here's the bigger point. Here's the bigger point, right? 49% white doesn't make you the minority. That's not how math works, right? 49% white is only the minority if you think the other 51% is exactly the same, right? It only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way that works.
Hari Kondabolu and I spoke last year. Welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have
you
on the show.
Thank you very much. That's the most aggressive version of that joke that I have. Like, I've done that so many times. And the one that's actually recorded officially is, like, the most aggressive version. Because I try to – because I know because the content's pretty heavy, so I try to deliver that one a little lighter, sillier. But, like, that night, like, just –
Well, the audience,
they're
the audience that you're taping.
Yeah,
I mean, I can't see them because it's a record album.
Yeah,
but they sound like they were in a frenzy.
Yeah. Oh my God, it was from the moment I walked out on stage, and it's funny because during the recording, because we did two that night. The first one was the one we draw like primarily almost all from, and I knew like it was going to sound different because they were like screaming and cheering like they were like at a rally the whole thing. And I remember being really frustrated when I got off stage. I'm like, that's not what a stand-up record is supposed to sound like. And Kamau was there because he surprised me and he like came to the recording.
Comedian W. Kamau Bell.
W. Kamau Bell. And he's like, that was incredible. And I'm like, they were screaming the whole time. And he's like, that's great because it was like they were at a rock concert. They were so excited to see you. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not what comedy records sound like. And he's like, yeah, and yours is going to sound different, which makes it good. Yours is going to sound distinct. And like I thought about, you know, why that happened and what made that recording special. And it's Oakland was on fire like the day or two before because it was after the Trayvon verdict the week before. Like Fruitvale was out. And so there were all these confrontations with cops like the night before and the night before that. And people were at my show who were dealing with the verdict, who were dealing with what had happened in Oakland and who told me after the show, like, we needed that. That was important. So now it all makes sense. Like, that's why people were screaming. Like, I was somehow connected emotionally to what they had been through, and I was saying stuff that obviously is like really political and about race, and it was a release for them. So I was their release. So the album is that release in Oakland. But at the time when I'm on stage, it was like not horrifying, but certainly like this is not what I expected. Like,
here's the thing. I think for a lot of comedians, they get worried when they are getting cheers instead of laughter.
Yes.
Because it means that they're, you know, rather than doing their ultimate goal, which is to be maximum amount of funny,
yes,
what they're doing is confirming something about the audience. That
yeah, it's I hate it so much. And so, like, for me, it was like, this stuff is funny. I've seen all this stuff work. I did this stuff the week before in Seattle. It killed. So it's like, just laugh. I just need you to laugh. But, like, afterwards, I think considering everything and all the factors, and it was special. Like, why am I upset that the album sounds different and it doesn't sound like anything else? And the fact people are cheering and screaming about that.
One of the things that I was reading about your days in Seattle, where you did most of your starting out in stand-up comedy, was a description of how proud you were, your description of how proud you were of bringing a mixed audience culturally, ethnically, gender-wise, to comedy. And that part of that was that there were necessarily some people that you were kind of introducing to comedy.
Yeah. I hear a lot of people say, like, I don't really like comedy, but I like you. Or I've never been to a comedy club before, but I really want to see you. And there's good things in that. Like, I have a unique audience, and I have people who specifically want to see me. And which comedian doesn't want that? Like, somebody who actually – audience who gets what they're doing. But you also deal with folks who – don't know how comedy clubs work, or folks that don't always get joke structure or how things work, or things like that. So, I mean, there's ups and downs, but you also have audiences that I can do the master's class of an idea, you know what I mean, of a joke. I don't need to just stop at the first punchline and, like, they're not going to get the rest of this. I can actually dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And for me, it forces me, if I'm working on a new thing, to go further, because I think, like, oh, you're going to get it. So I trust you and you trust me. Let's just see where it goes.
Alternative comedy, which is, you know, I mean, it's a slightly problematic descriptor, but I think it's useful. Alternative comedy is a world that I would say in a lot of places, neither the audience nor the performer base are particularly diverse.
Right.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. To some extent, being alternative is kind of a luxury.
That's funny, yeah.
But I wonder how you feel you fit into that world.
Jeez, Jesse, it feels like you're in my head. It's funny. These questions are questions no one's asked and that I have thought about. Seattle is a version of that. Like, we had an alternative scene, but it was such a smaller scene that everybody had to do everything, right? So you have many different styles. And so what I do, which is, like, heavily talks about race and politics, but also I play with the form. Like, I guess playing with the form, that aspect of it, I suppose, again, for lack of a better term, is an alternative thing to do. Like, not just choose conventional ways to tell a joke. But I do talk about race a lot. And a lot of alternative spaces, when you're, like, aggressively talk about race or politics or are earnest, like, you know, you're DOA. You know, I've had to navigate that, but in Seattle it was a little different because, like, I could do that because I was it. There weren't, you know what I mean? There was no one else doing that.
You were speaking on behalf of that.
Everybody, every person of color was, you know, and I was good. It was also one. The other thing was that, you know, not to say that that Seattle doesn't have great comics, but, like, you know, there's fewer of us, so there's, like, a handful of us that are really doing stuff that people want to come and see. So, like, I was good. And at the end of the day, I had the results. Now, going to L.A. or New York, for example, when you have, like, lots of comics and the scenes are, I think, more fragmented at times, like, it gets a little weird at times. I've been in rooms where I'm, like, the only one really talking about race, or I'm the only person of color performing, and it does feel a little weird. And I don't always fit neatly into that. And I've had to think to myself, and I hate this, I'm like, all right, let me slip that Weezer joke in here. Like, let me that old vegan soul food joke I used, let's throw that in. You know what I mean? Like, there's these things that sometimes I think, okay, if I come off too aggressive, I'm going to lose them. If I show them I care, I'm going to lose them. So let me slip in a variety of different things to just mix it up and keep that room fresh. And it's unfortunate that I have to think that way.
I'll finish my conversation with Hari Kondabolu after a break. We'll talk about the weird and largely unsolicited feedback he's received from audience members. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Thanks for listening to Bullseye. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you recite Taylor Swift lyrics better than Sir Patrick Stewart? Care to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts. That's npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Jesse here. So NPR is going to be taking over the Bullseye podcast feed starting in September. You will still be subscribed, but if your podcast preferences are set to download all new episodes, warning, you might find that your podcatcher tries to download our entire back catalog. So if you want to avoid that, it's pretty simple. You just need to switch your podcast app to download the most recent episode or the most recent three episodes or whatever is your preference, just not all of them for a minute, because otherwise you're going to get 800 downloaded. Anyway, sorry for the inconvenience. It's the only good way for us to make this transition over to NPR servers and keep our back catalog available to you, which a lot of folks wanted. So, yeah, thank you. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is comedian Hari Kondabolu. His comedy album is called Waiting for 2042. When you perform stand-up comedy, do you get feedback that is like detailed notes about what you did wrong?
Oh, yeah. from both sides. I don't know, sides are bizarre to even say sides. But like from folks who oh, God, this is not quite answering. But one of the first times I did comedy in Seattle, somebody suggested that I do it with a Nehru collar, that I always wore shirts that had a Nehru collar.
Wait, who suggested this?
I don't want to say his name.
The comedy store guy in 1979?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'll get people who, I mean, there's always the folks who are like, you know, stop, you know, you talk about race too much. Stop talking about race. You know, all you talk about is racist things that happen to you. I'm like, if they stopped happening, I would stop talking about them. You know, like, I don't get all your references. Do you think you're smarter than me? So there's that. And then there's, or people who just disagree with me being a comedian. Like, you are not a comedian. That is not funny. You are not a comedian. I'm like, I am a comedian. I think I am a comedian. I am in this space. They hired me to be a comedian. And then there's folks who like my stuff, and if I slip up in any way or if I say anything they don't agree with, there's a detailed explanation of what I did wrong and how I'm supposed to fix it. Or here are things you should write jokes about, and how come you haven't written a joke about this yet? As if you could just do it.
And it's like a list of transgressions and tragedies.
Yes,
right?
Yes, or topics, or you know, this is your reading list. So I get a part of me feels like, am I asking for this? Maybe I'm asking for this, but it's also hard to explain to people that comedy is evolving. So I might say something, because I've said things on stage I regret that are terrible, awful, miserable things. Sometimes I've wrote them, which makes me feel worse that I actually wrote it. And sometimes there are things that I say in the moment because I feel weak and I think about them. And if I can fix it on stage, I will. But sometimes I don't catch it till after and I think about, man, that is messed up. And yeah, that logic doesn't hold. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'm like, you know, maybe everyone didn't go to college and maybe it's not fair for me to talk with such assumptions. And, you know, there's all sorts of things that I have to try to fix. And I feel like I did something wrong and I have to fix it. But it's hard to, like, you have to figure that out. And comedy is amazing because you can address something immediately and you can talk about things immediately after they happen. But it also means because you're doing it immediately and it's an immediate reaction, reactions aren't always as thought out as they need to be. You're reacting. And I think it's hard, especially when you have a lot of fans who have never been to comedy and aren't obsessed with comedy the way I am and have always been. They don't get that, like, oh, he's figuring it out. I'm figuring it out. It requires growth. Stand-up requires growth. Like, sometimes sets are scratch paper. Sometimes sets are first drafts. It's the only art form where, you know, you're doing multiple takes, but people are actually watching the different takes, and they're judging the different takes. And you want to edit it out of your life, and you can't because they see it. That's hard. That's what makes it magical, but that's what makes it hard. And I wish sometimes people would cut us a little slack, because that's part of our growth. And we're growing, and that's why something I would have maybe said in the first time, maybe I'll say something different that goes against what I said in the first one. Why? That's growth. I'm a human. I changed my opinion, or I've rethought it, or I found a new angle to it. That's okay.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Hari Kondabolu. His debut album is Waiting for 2042, and I'm going to play another clip from it here. This is Hari, who lives in Brooklyn, describing a black woman caring for a white kid walking down the street.
Right. Chances are that's the nanny and the child she's taking care of. And I'm trying to walk by these two people on the street when I overhear what the black woman is saying to the white child. This is what she's saying. Toby, your name is Toby. Can you say it? That's your name. Say it. Your name is Toby. Your name is Toby. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, all right. About 20 of you in the core demographic. For the rest of you who are like, why is this interesting? His name is Toby. There's a book/miniseries by Alex Haley called Roots. And in Roots, a slave, Kunta Kinte, is brought to America and is told his name is Toby and refuses to be called Toby, so he's whipped repeatedly. Your name is Toby, Kunta Kinte, whip. Toby, Kunta Kinte, whip. Absolutely horrific. Now, flash forward to my neighborhood in Brooklyn 2 years ago. I saw a black woman tell a white child that his name was Toby. And there was nobody else there to see this. It was just me the whole time, like, what the, wow. Wow. I have been in a writing slump. This is perfect.
Almost every joke on your album has a joke and then an extended series of explanations,
yes,
about why and how you chose to tell that joke, yeah, in that particular way.
That initially started as a joke that nobody got. And then I'm like, well, I need to explain why it's funny to me, and then you'll understand it. And you're told you're never supposed to explain it, but like, that's, come on, there's so much meat there once you explain it. You just have to like put it out there and let people catch up with you. And honestly, that became funny to people too, the fact I was willing to explain Roots. Because for the people who know what Roots is, it's like hilarious. For people who didn't immediately make the connection, but then once I explained, they remembered, it's great. It just kind of brings the joke back to life.
I think there's also a sort of interesting element in you essentially forcing cultural competency onto the audience, like saying, like just grabbing the audience by the shoulders and being like, white people, I'm going to break this down for you. I know that you've never had to go through the inconvenience of learning about someone,
right,
else's frame of reference.
Right, right. It's, I mean, it doesn't always work because it also requires white people that are willing to have that experience. Do you know what I mean? So you can't force people to like, what, you didn't do the required reading? All right, hold on a sec. Like, it's a very bizarre.
You'll get your bell hooks book at the door.
Right. I've thought about that, like, like adding footnotes or like giving people a list of references like right before, so instead of an opening act, they could study up, and then I'd go out and do the set I really want to do, like with references only my friends would get. And I mean, the best shows though are the shows where you feel like you're performing for friends, even though you haven't met anybody in the room.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the comedian Hari Kondabolu. His debut stand-up album is called Waiting for 2042. Hari, I want to play a clip from this short film that you made, and I'm sorry for playing a clip from something you made when you were, you know, 25 years old or whatever. But in this, you play a version of yourself, but you also play a comic named Manoj, who is a very successful local comedian and kind of a rising star. Let's listen.
We go over to some popular Hindus and Hindons. Eating a sandwich, Hindu, Hindu. Eating a beef sandwich, Hindon't. Having sex after marriage, Hindu. Eating beef, Hindon't. Riding in a rickshaw, Hindu. Riding a cow, Hindon't, that's beef. That is beef.
So long ago. It's funny because the film is just about the idea of exploding your ethnicity for laughs or for success, and playing on you know kind of reinforcing people's stereotypes and assumptions. And I hear it now, I think it's still somewhat relevant, but it does feel a little more dated, even though it hasn't been that long ago. I feel like things have changed so rapidly. You have a generation that also grew up with South Asians and some experiences, and it's not just Apu anymore. Like, you have, like, the ascent of, like, Aziz Ansari and Mindy Kaling, who are also creating their own content, and Cal Penn. Like, there's just so much, you know, and Cal Penn playing roles that he deserves, like better roles, and, like, Asif being on The Daily Show. Like, there's all this stuff that has happened since that point that I don't think it's not true, and it's not to say that there aren't people that are still kind of exploiting it and doing, like, lowest common denominator stuff, but it is funny to hear that and think so much has happened since I made that short.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Apu.
Yeah.
Since Apu has come up.
Yeah.
You did a piece on Totally Biased, the late night FX show that you were a writer for.
May it rest in peace.
About Apu. Let's take a listen to a portion of that.
Apu, a cartoon character voiced by Hank Azaria, a white guy. A white guy doing an impression of a white guy making fun of my father. If I saw Hank Azaria do that voice at a party, I would kick the shit out of him. Yeah. Or I'd imagine kicking the shit out of him.
Apu is a really troubling figure. You know, he embodies some stereotypes about South Asian people.
Yeah. He's an Indian dude that works at a quickie mart.
Yeah. and he's voiced by a white person right. in a very broad accent.
Right.
You know, he's further problematized by the fact that he's on the greatest comedy show of the last...
Yeah.
One of the greatest comedy shows of all time. Yeah. Certainly the greatest comedy show of our generation.
Yes.
And that he's, over the years, become a very rich, interesting character.
Yes, yes. And I love that show, grew up on that show, and I love the character. It's that bizarre thing where I loved the character but hated the fact it was it and that it was the accent and everything else. And it was because he was funny, you know, even outside of the accent. Like, especially when contrasted with Homer at times, incredible, right? But it was just like, that's all we get, and that's what I get called at school. Like, that is the thing that's supposed to hurt me, which is very bizarre, right? Like, you love a show, and that has to be an insulting thing. But we didn't have any. It was that or Gandhi, which is pretty broad in terms of perspective, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, also that, like, I would never have to go to school and worry about being called
Homer
or
right,
Bart.
Right, like, well,
or
you do have...
Disco Stew, unless I was wearing Disco Stew.
Right. You do have spiky hair like Bart. Right. I mean, it was a strange thing. And again, the accent was kind of ridiculous. I saw some interview with Hank Azaria, who does the voice of Apu on YouTube, and he was asked about the character. And he talks about how when he was auditioning and doing different voices, they asked him, can he, you know, do an Indian accent? And he's like, he did it. And he's like, but, you know, it's really stereotyped. It's not very good. And they're like, oh, that's fine. And it's like, why is that fine? It's because, like, we didn't exist. Like, we existed, but, like, who's going to say anything? Nobody cares. Who's the audience watching it? Like, my generation of kids was not considered. Like, it didn't matter if we felt anything or if that had an impact. But, you know, we grew up having to deal with it. And even though it was funny and all that, like, that was part of it. I remember when I was writing that piece for Totally Biased, you know, I had that Apu piece in, and... It just felt corny. It felt corny to talk about it. Like, why am I talking about Apu? Like, I've talked about this forever, and it's already, like, 2012, 2013. And Kamal said, this is amazing. And, no, you've talked about Apu for years. You and your friends have talked about Apu for years. You and your family have talked about Apu for years. No one's ever talked about him this way. No one has talked about, like, the impact it's had on you or your friends and family, how ridiculous the character is and how it's a relic of another time. And I was really proud to do it when I thought about it that way. Yeah, I guess no one has talked about it. It's funny to, like, you know, me and Hank Azaria have had, like, Twitter exchanges about it. And I guess...
What was that like?
Surreal. It was surreal because I love Hank Azaria and I love that show. And someone had done a piece on HuffPo about Huffington Post about Apu, and they interviewed Hank Azaria. And Hank Azaria said that, you know, the first thing that made him question it was my piece, that he had seen it, and it really shook him. It, like, made him reconsider, because he thought if there was only, like, one Jewish character and it was that, like, yeah, he would be bummed too. And that was incredible, the idea that I made something that reached the voice of Apu and in any way, like, questioned the Simpsons world, and somebody from the world actually heard it, because I love that show. Like, I love that show. And it was a big influence on me just outside of that character. Like, a big part of how I view comedy. So the fact that Hank Azaria had any response to it and it was positive is amazing, mind-blowing.
Hari, I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show.
Oh, thank you, Jesse. This is great.
Hari Kondabolu. His debut album is called Waiting for 2042. If you want to see him live, check out harikondabolu.com. Every week we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's the Outshot. Harvey Pekar was a pretty regular guy. He'd tell you that himself. Pekar was a record collector. He loved jazz, especially swing and bebop. And one day in the early 70s, this friend tells him he knows this other guy who's also a collector. And this other guy's more into old-timey stuff. So these two guys, Harvey and the other guy, they get in touch and they meet up because they figure they can trade with each other. You know, old-timey for bebop, swing for ragtime, that kind of thing. And this other guy turns out to be R. Crumb. Pekar wasn't an artist, but he was kind of a self-taught intellectual, curious about everything. And he had this thought knocking around in his head. Comics, he figured, were just words and pictures. So why'd they have to be superhero things, or Sunday funnies, or even weird trip-out hippie stuff? Couldn't they just be anything? Couldn't they be about normal stuff? So he wrote up some stories with some stick figures, and he showed them to Crumb just one day when they were hanging out and talking about jazz. And Crumb read them, and he loved them. Pekar's stories weren't anything that there'd been comics about before. They were just stories from the life of a regular guy. And that's how Pekar created American Splendor, a little comic that did everything completely differently. Like, here's one storyline. Pekar's talking about picking a lane at the grocery store, being careful who you get behind, watching out for slow cashiers, and especially avoiding old ladies because they are the slowest. But on this one day, he's got to get a couple things, and so he picks the express line. But it's the express line with a lousy cashier, one who gave him the wrong change once. And there's an old lady, of course. And she's holding everything up. She's pulling out coupons and counting pennies, and he's just sort of running through all the anxieties in his head and getting really pissed off. So she finally finishes, and Pekar gets up to the counter. But the old lady's not leaving. She has a question about the receipt, and he's thinking, this dumb old woman's probably going to lie, and she's going to say she got short change, and she's going to call for the manager, and it's going to be this whole thing. But actually what she does, she totters back to the check stand, and she says to the cashier, "Ma'am, I think you gave me an extra quarter." And the cashier insists that she didn't because she's a lousy cashier and she doesn't want to admit that she's a lousy cashier. But she's wrong. She did. And eventually, she takes back the quarter. And it's right there at the end that you know that it's a story from American Splendor. A lot of the stories have lessons, but they don't wrap up nice. There aren't grand arcs, just these moments. Laundromats, helping friends move, weird coworkers, going to the movies. I've never read anything that so perfectly captures, you know, the times when you're not sure what the hell you're doing with your life, or just what it's like to walk home from work and think. American Splendor makes putting one foot in front of the other feel like something special. The comic used to be billed as "From Off the Streets of Cleveland, American Splendor." It's just perfect. Pekar's great gift was to imbue ordinary lives with the grandeur of superheroes. Not by juicing them up or heightening them or making them into soap operas, but just by giving them the respect they deserve. His gift was making the human superhuman. Thanks, Harvey. That's my outshot. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye, our show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith, production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abadia Nex Perello. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. Our thanks to Chris Berube this week for his editing help. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they're all free. Go to MaximumFun.org or grab the show in whatever you use to listen to podcasts. And if you want a show that's like this show, but chattier, then check out Pop Rocket. It is a roundtable discussion of everything that is great in popular culture, hosted by comedian Guy Branum. It is really fun, really funny, really insightful. I think you'll really like it. Check it out. Give it a shot. Pop Rocket. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.